You are listening to John Diard's Life Spa, your premier source for health news and Ayurveda, where modern science meets ancient wisdom.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. John Diard, and welcome to LifeSpa.com, where we prove the ancient medical wisdom of Ayurveda with modern science. And today, we have a special guest. His name is Dr. Alex Tatum, and he's a specialist in peptides. You've probably all heard the buzz about peptides, and they're coming, but they're not legal, and what's the status of them, and are they safe? All these questions are going to be answered by Dr. Alex Tatum. He's a board-certified urologist. He's a specialist in men's health. He has a clinic, the Men's Health Clinic of Urology in Indiana, where he supports all of his clients there. He has a YouTube channel called @DrAlexTatum, and there you can follow him on YouTube to stay abreast of the cutting-edge changes that are taking place in the really fast-moving and changing industry of peptides. There's a lot going on, you know, in the government, in the CDC, right now as we speak, in terms of, you know, making these legal, making them available to the masses, as opposed to just being something that people are doing online for research purposes only and taking risks. So it's really about to change dramatically. If you're interested in this, stay tuned. Watch this podcast. Dr. Tatum has given us an amazing, base understanding of what peptides are, how they work, and, you know, how we can stay abreast of the changing information. Well, let's start with telling me a little bit about the history of peptides. I mean, I don't think people realize that insulin is a peptide. Everybody obviously knows GLP-1 is, but there's been a lot of peptides, you know, kind of with pharmaceuticals for quite some time. Isn't that true?
Yeah. So peptides are not necessarily new, right? Peptides have been around for 1921 was the first time that insulin was isolated. And I think that it's important for people to understand that when we traditionally think of drugs and medications, we think of them by therapeutic class. So for example, like statins, this is a family of medications that all have a similar structure and they do a similar thing. They approach a certain enzyme present in cholesterol synthesis to try and reduce your low density lipoprotein. Okay, got it. But peptides aren't like that. Peptides are a structural class of medications. So these are medications that are made up of little bits of amino acids. So almost like beads on a string. And amino acids are the building blocks of life, of proteins. You know, when you take a protein supplement, when I take a protein supplement, you know, that is made up of amino acids. And so, you know, peptides have been in us, you know, since creation. And we've been isolating them and using them in medicine for over 100 years. It's just now finally we've managed to understand what's called the epigenome. So not just what's in our genetics, but what do those genetics turn into, right? Okay, at the end level, at the protein level, how can we isolate those different tools? And then how can we then use them and leverage them in a therapeutic sense? So peptides may sound new. It's a new hip crazy thing. It's not new. It's been around for a long time. It's just now kind of reaching a public zeitgeist.
Wow. Wow. So there are some like really famous peptides, like oxytocin is a peptide. Is that correct?
Correct. Oxytocin is a peptide that, you know, traditionally, if you look at the FDA indication for that, you know, it's only FDA indication is for uterine contractions, which is something that, you know, obviously does a great job. Pitocin, which it's used on labor and delivery floors throughout the United States, really throughout the world. But we know that oxytocin does a lot more than just, you know, uterine contractions, right? I mean, it is critical for pair bonding. It is critical for that emotional warmth that drives so many of our interpersonal interactions. And, you know, it's why I think it's critical not just to understand how these peptides work on their formal labeling, but how do they work biochemically and how can we leverage them in different ways to get different results? So, for example, oxytocin, you can take that as an intranasal spray before, you know, having an emotional experience, you know, maybe with your significant other, maybe in a group. Now, some people I know have utilized that as part of therapy or part of, you know, date night or whatever the case may be. And so I think getting to the biology of each of these compounds is really important. So that way you can really understand how they could be used, because it's like a screwdriver. You can use a screwdriver for a million different things, right? Not just, you know, I use mine to chip paint sometimes, right? Like if you understand the core function of it, you can utilize it in different ways.
Yeah, no, thanks for doing this. I really feel like a lot of folks, our listeners are probably, many of them, new to peptides. And, you know, the idea that oxytocin, which, you know, research calls it the longevity hormone, and you can make it by loving and giving and caring for others, you know, is something that is so fundamental to human health, where dopamine, reward chemistry hormone, you have to stimulate the body to make it. Where, and it's limited by how much stimulation, you know, you have to, if you stimulate it, you kind of burn out those receptors. You got to keep stimulating more and more higher levels of dose, where oxytocin, the more you love, the more you give, the more you make, it never runs out. Like that's the difference between a peptide and a hormone. Hormones by definition will be depleted when you give a hormone. It by definition means it'll stop you from making your own, where peptides seem to work the opposite. The more that you love and give and be kind, the more oxytocin you can make, and you can make is there's no limit to it. And I wonder, is that something that's sort of true with all peptides, that there's no kind of tolerance built up over time? Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, I don't want to say there's no tolerance built up over time, because I'll just use the example of looking at GLP-1 drugs. And so, for example, like it's not like, oh, you become, you start a GLP-1, go up on the dose, and then you become immune to it and that you have to keep going higher. But we do know that some of the worst side effects of GLP-1s, like the worst nausea. Okay. So, and again, just for those of your listeners, you know, tuning in that may not know that term GLP-1, I'm talking about things like Ozempic, Wegovy, Zepbound, and Mounjaro, these medications that are primarily used for diabetes control, weight loss. They slow gastric emptying. And we know that nausea and vomiting are some of the biggest side effects, but it tends to be limited to when you escalate the dose, and then the body does accommodate. And so there is a little bit of what I might describe as not tolerance, but attenuation to a peptide signal. And so our bodies are very dynamic. We are going to respond to inputs that come in it. But I will agree with you on the point that we do not see the same sort of effects from hormonal manipulation that we do with peptides. And so, for example, I'm a big proponent of testosterone therapy. I'm a testosterone patient myself. But as I just had to have a very serious conversation with a patient today, you know, he had a normal testosterone level, but he just wanted to try it. And again, he had a normal free testosterone. He also had no demonstrable like symptoms of low testosterone. And so like I had to have a very real conversation with him that if he starts taking testosterone, he will stop making his own. And although you should be able to recover that after a brief trial, you need to understand that it's not necessarily a free lunch, right? Like, you know, I wouldn't recommend trying testosterone the way that you might want to try, like, I don't know, a new restaurant. Like you may want to just walk with me for a minute, talk to me, you know? And so, but peptides, for example, we see nothing like that with BPC-157 or TB-500 when it comes to like healing from an injury. So patient comes in like, oh, I want to try this. You know, as soon as we have access to that again, I mean, I'll be the first one like, absolutely. Let's give that a go, because it doesn't have that barrier to entry. You know, it's not, you don't have that squeeze, you know, you still get the juice, but you don't get that same squeeze.
Wow. So let's kind of maybe start by talking to us about the, you know, the legality of it. What's happening with the regulation? What's RFK doing? I understand that they're maybe in July, they're going to be, you know, loosely regulated or regulated in a way where everybody can get access to them without using research dose only. Talk to us about where they stand from a legal point of view and a little bit about the safety as well.
Yeah. So what I will say is that right now there's a bit of a saga that kind of goes into peptides, and it very closely ties in to compounding pharmacies here in the United States. I'm going to try to make this brief because I don't want to bore anyone in your audience. But, you know, obviously everyone knows CVS and Walgreens and corner pharmacies, but, you know, that's not what pharmacy started out as. I mean, pharmacy started out as your pharmacist that you know by name, who gets a paper script from your doctor, who makes a medication that that doctor prescribes, and they usually will do it on the counter in front of you and then provide it for you. And that was, you know, the most intimate form of healthcare and personalized medicine that used to be the standard. You know, we just didn't have very good tools back then, right? Because we didn't understand medication, we didn't understand the human body as well. But compounding pharmacies have persisted, and they are still a staple here in America, and they're critical for personalized medication. And the thing is that there was a big problem with a specific compounding pharmacy called the New England Center for Compounding in 2013, where they had some gross negligence when it came to their sterility control. And a lot of patients got really sick, and a lot more patients actually passed away. It was a terrible, terrible incident. And so the federal government got involved and said, hey, we need to regulate compounding pharmacies. And then, you know, they started to look at this and like, oh my gosh, like, you know, there's so much that goes into compounding. It's so complex. And you guys are using all these different compounds that aren't available at CVS and Walgreens. Okay, well, we can't figure all this out now. So we're going to give you what we call interim guidance. And that interim guidance is going to break all drugs up into three categories. Okay. Like, yes, okay, you can make all the stuff that you can find at CVS and Walgreens if you're making personalized doses. But for all the stuff that we don't really understand, we're going to put those in one of three categories. Category one means, okay, it looks safe. You can make this. Category two, we see some adverse safety signals. You cannot make this. And then category three, which is we just don't have enough data and we're not going to decide. We're not going to think about it right now. So what happened is that the majority of the peptides that we use in the health, wellness, and longevity space, or my particular brand of medicine, which is called performance medicine, those were all included on category one. And in 2014, that's when that category was invented. And, you know, we were all using those medications and patients getting really good results with no sign of any sort of adverse safety signal. And so those were utilized all the way through 2023. You know, I was introduced to these medications in 2018 as part of my fellowship training. And so in my world, I was like, oh, we have access to these. We'll always have access to these. But what happened is that on a random Friday, September 29th, 2023, the FDA uploaded a PDF to its website with no announcement, unilaterally moving 19 of these compounds from category one to category two, banning them for production or compounding overnight. And so it was terrible for patients. They lost access to medication instantly. And, you know, as doctors, we had to be the bearer of bad news. And so ever since then, you know, the compounds that have been dominating the current, you know, public discourse, BPC, TB, MOTC, KPV, Epithalon, DSIP, CMAX, all of these compounds that you hear and see about, those have not been legal for production for human consumption in the United States. And that is despite, you know, not having any sign of any adverse safety signal, even when the FDA was sued by the Compounders Association, the FDA received several FOIA requests and they failed to ever produce any evidence that there was any sign of a negative safety signal. So there's some suspicion, there is some pressure from Big Pharma to move those compounds to that category too. Again, that suspicion, you can't prove that. But now we have a new administration in place and RFK is very passionate about these peptides. He wants to improve access. And so what's happened is they have made a decision to take 12 of those 19 peptides that are originally banned. Those 12 have actually already been moved off of category two, and they are meeting to decide whether or not to issue a recommendation to the FDA to potentially put them back into category one. And so there are going to be seven compounds that are going to be considered on July 23rd and 24th. That is going to be by an independent board of physicians called the Pharmacy Compound Advisory Committee. They're going to look at all the data, and then they are going to submit their recommendation to the FDA. The FDA doesn't have to follow that, but it usually does. They follow rules-based lawmaking. That's going to be 30 to 60 days of looking for public comment, and then they're going to potentially make a decision, which means that the soonest we would get access to those seven compounds would potentially be October, November, and that would be if everything moved at lightning speed. And then the remainder five more compounds, I think they're not going to be decided on for several more months after that. So that's where things currently stand. As of right now, if you want any of these compounds that are kind of driving public discourse, your only option is to order them online from a middleman who just got them all from China.
And those are the ones that say for research use only? Is that what has to be on the label right now?
Well, correct. And so then it's called gray market. And the reason why it's called gray is because it's not technically black, because black would mean illegal, right? So drugs, that's black market. If you want to buy anabolic steroids, you know, those are illegal. And so that's going to be black market, illegal when purchased in that manner, anabolic steroids like testosterone, and a number of them are legal with a doctor's prescription. Some nuance there. But these compounds are considered research chemicals technically because of where they sit. And so because of that, you can make them and you can sell them if you're going to use them for research. So what happens? Well, you spin up a website and you put very clearly for research use only, and you sell them. There's a nod and a wink. Everyone knows that people are injecting these at home, and they constantly will try to attest to the purity of their product as opposed to their competitors. But yes, I mean, this is kind of an open secret, says research use only, but we all know that people are using them.
So nobody really knows how pure these are from one provider to another, right? So at this point, would you say it's a pretty slippery slope?
Well, what I would say is this. I describe it as gas station sushi, okay? I mean, you know what? Yeah. You may have like a BP station on your corner, and man, you know the guy that works there, and he's got a hookup with some amazing gas station sushi. And you know that you can go there every Friday and get lunch, and you know it treats you just fine. But it's not going to be like that at every gas station. And also, you know, who knows if this week is going to be as good as next week's. And so there's an inherent amount of uncertainty there simply because it's not regulated. And so are there good actors in the space that work very hard to provide very good certificates of analysis that are up to date, examining every shipment they get? There are, but there's also people that are selling mystery white powder that has nothing of what you paid for. And you're kind of taking that, that chance whenever you dip your toes in those waters.
Wow. So you mentioned that there are seven that are going to be moving to category one and maybe be available. Would that be by doctor's prescription, or who would be providing these? Just any company can get it online?
No, it has to be with a prescription. And so that has to be from a physician, a nurse practitioner, or a physician assistant. Now, obviously, we are going to see a lot of telehealth companies start to offer this. But telehealth companies have been offering prescription medication for, you know, many, many years now. And they do that through a distributed telehealth network of doctors, PAs, and nurse practitioners. So these are not, like, this decision is not to try and figure out whether or not you can buy BPC at your local Conoco station. Like, these are going to be made by 503A compounding pharmacies that are following USP standards when it comes to making medication.
So all of a sudden, this becomes something that, you know, any doctor can prescribe. How many doctors actually know anything about peptides?
Not as many as need to. I'll tell you that. Not many, John. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why I got into social media, is obviously to educate patients, but also to, you know, educate my colleagues, because I think that we all know that there is a problem here in America where we have developed, you know, by intention or just luck, this sick care system where we're really good at, if someone's arm is falling off, putting it back on. And if you got diabetes, well, we can give you medication to bring that sugar down, make that number go down. But we're really, really bad at looking at the whole patient. We're really, really bad at preventative care. We're really bad at saying, oh, hey, like, how can I help you be the healthiest version of you? Okay. Rather than the less sick version of you. And so my hope is that, you know, we can see a wave of physician education kind of draft on this public interest. And I really hope we can start to change the conversation and have a more holistic view in how we treat patients.
Right. So would there be a way to find a doctor who knows what he's doing or what she's doing when this hopefully becomes legal in the next 3 or 6 months for folks who are just thinking about trying this or learning more about it?
Yeah, I mean, I will tell you this, John. The other day, my parents live just down the street from me. I joke that, you know, I live in Mayberry. Like, I've got this, you know, a lovely, you know, modest home. I've got a wife and two kids. My parents live just 5-6 blocks away. And kind of, I joke that the trade is that, you know, my parents help out so much with the kids and are there for us. And then I try to help them navigate the healthcare industry. And I'm a physician, and I think it's a mess, because trying to find someone who is a subspecialist outside of, you know, my space is really difficult. And even then, like, I'm not in the operating room with someone who's a surgeon. You know, I don't know necessarily if they get good outcomes. Like, that's not published. It's not on Yelp. And, you know, you can hear good things, and people can even have good Google reviews, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're good at what they do. And by, you know, on the opposite side, I've actually met some surgeons that have horrible people skills and you'd never want to talk to them, but they're amazing at their job and they're really technically really, really good. And so I guess that's the long way of saying, no, I don't have a really effective way of directing patients to anything meaningful at this time. I am actively talking to different groups that are interested in this space about, you know, how we can develop that. Like, how can we develop like standardized protocols that can be distributed over a large network to that way there's something that I could point patients to and say, hey, like I live in the middle of a cornfield in Indiana, but if you live elsewhere, like we've got these other resources where we can point you where you can get like quality, you know, peptide education, not just get it, because, you know, we want to educate you. We want to point you in the right direction. We want to provide guidance, and it needs to be a shared decision between yourself and a knowledgeable provider. So I don't have that today, but I will tell you that it's something I personally am working on and a lot of really smart people are working on. And I'm hoping that we will have much better insight from July.
Okay. So let's kind of dig into the, you know, how peptides actually work. Or are they sort of a key that unlocks the, you know, the cell membrane to allow these proteins to actually get inside the cell, and each peptide has a different kind of structure, like every key has a different structure, and therefore each structure has a different purpose. Is that kind of how peptides are working? Or how does it work inside the cell? How does it get inside the cell? You know, what makes them tick?
Well, it really depends. So I would say that if you're looking at something like semaglutide is a huge peptide. You know, I think if I'm remembering, it's like over 4,000 Daltons, which is that's giant. You know, that's the equivalent of a container ship trying to go through like a local, like, you know, harbor. But that has a defined receptor, the GLP-1 receptor. All right. But that's not the case with all peptides, right? If we look at something like KPV, which is like a tiny little 3-amino acid peptide, it actually goes through the cell membrane and is grabbed by another protein called PEPT1, which has been identified in different gastric cells as a non-cellular membrane bound way to transport that protein into cells. And then you've got, you know, real weird ones like MOTC, which is actually not made, like it's not encoded in the nuclear DNA of a cell, it's encoded in the mitochondrial DNA. And so it directly comes from the powerhouse of your cell, then goes into the cell nucleus and then tells the cell nucleus, hey, make more mitochondria. And also, hey, let's make our AMPK pathway more efficient while we're at it. And so think of peptides as just little machines that can all work in different ways.
Wow. So once inside the cell, you know, it's anybody's guess. Well, I guess somebody knows, but they all do different things once inside the cell, basically.
Don't think that everybody knows, because, for example, BPC, we still have not identified a BPC receptor. We don't really know how that works. Yeah. So that's still a big question mark. So, we still have a lot left to learn. And the hope is that we can start to learn that after we get access to these medications, because we're not going to be able to follow the traditional FDA pathway with this, because these compounds are all found naturally. U.S. patent law actually prevents them from ever being patented, so there's no financial incentive for pharma companies to go through the traditional phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 trials. So,
Is it like marijuana, where the research hasn't been done on it until it's now become legal and now we're finding more about it? Is it similar to that, where we don't have a lot of research, or because it's been around forever?
That's actually a really good example to bring up, because cannabis is something that's been around for a very long time, but we didn't really have any formal data on it, mostly because it's always been a scheduled substance, right? I mean, I think right now, federally, I think it's still Schedule 1, which is crazy. Absolutely crazy. So, I mean, no one's going to take that risk when it comes to trying to do clinical trials on it. And so what the cannabis industry had to do is they had to rely on something called real world evidence, which is considered to be a lower quality of evidence, but actually highly valuable, because it's what's happening in the real world, where you make it available to patients, and then you call them and you talk to them afterwards, and you try to track outcomes at a population-based level. And so that is, again, our real-world evidence. RWE is a formal discipline in the space of statistics and medicine and public health. And that is actually the same strategy that is looking to be leveraged with peptides, because we especially, again, I hate to say peptides in general, because yes, insulin's a peptide, the GLP-1s are peptides. I'm talking about specifically the peptides that are up for consideration for compounding again. But that's a strategy that is, you know, going to be employed, so that way we can get as much data as quickly as possible to ensure that we're maintaining safety standards. And again, for all the compounds that were being considered right now, the next seven especially, we have not seen profound adverse safety signals in their entire history of use. So people should feel better about that. Okay. They should be reassured by that. And we're going to keep working to make sure we keep getting that data to maintain that certainty.
So these are mostly injectables, but you can actually get oral tablets, sublingual tablets. What's the difference in effectiveness? So maybe, you know, from the different delivery systems.
So what I would tell people is that, generally speaking, okay, subcutaneous administration is going to be the standard for most peptides. And the reason why is that the oral, straight up oral administration, like swallowing it, okay, your body doesn't really know the difference between a piece of chicken and a peptide in most cases. All right. Now, there are some very notable exceptions to that. So, for example, KPV and BPC-157 arginate, which is the salt that's attached to it, as opposed to BPC-157 acetate, which is the injectable form. The BPC-157 arginate and KPV have been shown to be orally bioavailable, and that's what's been shown to provide efficacy in the inflammatory bowel disease model in all of the animal studies. And so, yes, there are peptides that are orally available. Now, when you start to get into the more esoteric administrations, like sublingual, trying to go through mucous membranes in the mouth, and like intranasal sprays, that's something that's very popular. For example, Epitalon, C-Max, you know, is another one. Like, those have not necessarily been studied quite as well, depending on the delivery. Like BPC-157 nasal spray, no one studied that, at least not to my knowledge. So I would say that the go-to standard should be sub-Q injection, with specific exceptions for compounds that have gut activity that have been proven to work.
And then how long do you expect to see a change when you take and when you get an injection? And we have to do this every day for a period of time. Do you get on, get better, get off, or is it a life sentence? How does that work?
Well, it totally depends on the peptide, and it depends on the indication. So for example, if we're talking about something like using KPV, oral KPV, for alleviating, you know, symptoms of inflammatory bowel disease, which is going to be an autoimmune condition. Well, I mean, you know, KPV is not going to cure your immune system. The goal is to try and reduce inflammation in the gut to improve symptoms. So what I would tell patients is that the KPV is not a life sentence, but inflammatory bowel disease is a life sentence. And so if this is something that's effective for you, well, you're probably going to need to stay on it, you know, for quite some time. Now, right, there are exceptions to that. So, for example, if you have an acute injury, like, you know, a bicep or a tear, or, you know, a pec tear, that's something where injectable BPC and TB500 have found to be efficacious in anecdotal reports. And that's not something you're going to be on forever. You're going to take that for a set number of weeks, assist with the healing process, then you come off of it. And if we're looking for, you know, efficacy, obviously several weeks, if we're talking about BPC and TB500, because your endpoint is healing from an injury. But then you've got other compounds where, let's say, like a GLP-1, like if you do an injection of tirzepatide, like, I tell you what, man, I mean, you're going to feel pretty full and maybe a little more nauseous than you anticipated just, you know, 24 hours later. I mean, it hits pretty quickly. So just going back to the concept that don't think of peptides as having, you know, a very unified onset of action, unified mechanism of action. This is a very diverse group of compounds that are linked by their structure, not by how they work.
So the GLP-1, you prescribe that, or you've been using that? Do you have good experiences with that you can share?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, I personally took tirzepatide for a month purely out of treating myself like my own lab rat. I am very guilty of that. And I, when I'm speaking to my medical colleagues, I have to tell them that no, I do not think that you need to take every medicine you provide. I just happen to, you know, I joke that I am my own, you know, index patient. And I think that that was really helpful for me because it helps me counsel patients more effectively when we start to talk about side effects and ramps and that sort of thing. But yeah, I have had great results primarily with tirzepatide and a lot of my patients because, you know, I come from this world where men will come and seek me out, primarily ask about testosterone. That's been like the biggest, you know, thing before peptides, right? But you know, they come in and they're dealing with sleep apnea because they're overweight and they start testosterone and they wonder why, you know, they're not losing weight with testosterone. And I'm like, well, that's a totally different mechanism, my friend. Like, you know, yes, like you are going to potentially shift to more lean tissue anabolism versus taking on, you know, fat tissue when you're on testosterone as relatively, but ultimately, like your total weight, okay, is going to be related to caloric intake versus energy expenditure. And so, you know, we have to really, really work on diet. You know, you're probably eating a lot of calorically dense, but totally nutritionally deficient foods. I bet if I got a vitamin panel on you, it would look like a dumpster fire. Okay. And also, you say that you don't eat a lot. I don't believe you. Take a picture of like the foods that you eat in a day before your clinic, before you come to your clinic appointment. And let me look at it because it is so easy in our modern culture to eat things that come in boxes and cans, okay, that have expiration dates that are, you know, like, I don't know, like somewhere out past my 6-year-old's high school graduation date, right? And we think that's food. That's not food, okay? Like, food should spoil within probably about, you know, 4 to 5 days of you buying it if you're not refrigerating it, you know? So I realize that that may be a generalization. But encouraging whole food intake, mindfulness when it comes to the calorie to nutrition ratio of foods, and honestly, just trying to get patients to hit their protein goals and avoid empty calories, I mean, is what it all comes back to. And now we have medications in the form of GLP-1s that can turbocharge that process. And they do a lot of other things besides just calories. We're seeing incredible results when it comes to improving markers for cardiac disease, markers for cognition, markers for cancer risk, all going down. So GLP-1s do more than that, but that's their primary driver, primary interest.
Right. How real is the risk if someone's, taking testosterone and then they're converting that into estrogen if they're taking excess or have more than they need? And how common is that to relate to weight gain or even some growth factors that they don't want?
Yeah, so I mean that's something I see every day because you know we're kind of the catchment area for people that may have gone to I don't know more of a strip mall type clinic and you know just gotten a big dose of testosterone and there isn't consideration for that. So what I'll tell you is that you know we all have aromatase in our bodies. It's natural. It's the primary source of estradiol as men, but also you need estradiol. If you crush estrogen, that leads to some really, really bad things from a cardiac and cognitive standpoint. Also, some pretty significant sexual side effects. But what's important is that you have to keep that in balance with your testosterone levels. And so what is very common is, you know, the most prescribed version of testosterone here in the United States is testosterone cypionate. And what happens is that people draw big doses of that. They bolus dose that, you know, once a week, and then that spikes, that converts to estrogen, and then they end developing all these side effects. So you can avoid that by cutting the dose and then administering that multiple times throughout the week. I will tell people, I'm crazy, I know that, but I actually do very tiny microdoses of testosterone every single day. And I do that in what may be described as a compulsive ritual, where I'll backfill little tiny 1 cc syringes with a 30 gauge needle at the end. So I mean, you can barely feel it. It's very easy to administer, and it keeps my hormones, you know, absolutely locked. And so that's a strategy to avoid it. But if your estrogen goes through the roof, what's going to happen is you're going to get a lot of subcutaneous water accumulation. So you will put on weight, but it's quite literally water weight. Okay. And in addition to that, you're also going to get stimulation of breast tissue in the chest as a man, which is usually not what we're going for. You're also going to get sexual side effects. You're going to get emotional lability. I joke that guys will start crying at Lifetime movies a lot more than they ever intended. But also, I mean, they just get agitated. And so, you know, I tell people that your hormones are a balancing act and you can push or pull too hard in any direction. And it's our goal to not just give you the biggest dose, but the right dose.
Okay, man, this is fascinating. What about the seven? Can you just, I know you've probably done this a million times, but can you go over the seven major peptides that are looking to, you know, be available in the hopefully not too distant future?
Sure. So we have BPC-157, body protection compound 157, and TB-500, which is a subunit of thymosin beta-4. And these two compounds, their primary claim to fame is angiogenesis, so improving blood flow, and cellular recruitment for fibroblasts and other cellular repair factors. The idea being that these are going to be your go-to if you experience an injury. Now, there's also been talk about using them in a more long-term sense for people who are training really hard, you know, in, you know, their later years, and they want to constantly be recovering so they can go back at it. Evidence, I haven't seen, you know, solid as much evidence for that, even in, you know, the anecdotal space for the efficacy of that. But that is real. That is an application that people are using. Then we've got MOTC. And so MOTC is that mitochondrial peptide that is really fascinating. If you look at the animal data, it expanded the lifespans of mice. And also older mice started acting like younger mice. And it improved the insulin sensitivity in a mouse model. And mice started losing weight even whenever they're overweight. And they kept the same caloric intake. It was really, really wild. And it does this by upregulating AMPK. So you're boosting your basal metabolism. That's a really fascinating compound. And I mean, my personal theory is I think that that's going to become the new like standard to pair with GLP-1s in patients that are seeking to try and improve body composition. And then after that, you've got KPV, which is, you know, really it's a primarily an anti-inflammatory peptide, most known for its effects in the gut. And I think that that's going to be its primary use. Now, it has been used in combination with BPC and TB-500, along with another compound called GHK copper, GHKCU. GHKCU is not up for grabs right now, but those are all blended together and given as an anti-inflammatory cocktail, either the GLOW or if you add KPV in there to the others, then they call it CLOW, K-L-O-W. And so that's a common combination. So you've got those four, BPC, TB-500, MOTC, and KPV, but then you have the neurologic trio that's being considered. First is going to be C-Max. This is a Russian seven amino acid peptide that is really designed to improve cognition. It's thought to be a nootropic. And that is a really fascinating one because it also shows that there's some older data that shows potentially neuroprotective effects when administered to stroke patients. And so you have C-Max, you also have DSIP, Delta Sleep Inducing Peptide, which is going to help reset circadian rhythms and improve delta wave sleep. And then you also have Epitalon, which is actually comes from a pineal gland extract in cattle when it was first identified. We obviously make it in our pineal gland as well. You know, Descartes called the pineal gland the seat of the soul. You know, some people call it your third eye. It's a very, very important tiny little gland that controls so much of who we are and what we do right in the middle of our brains. And what's funny is that one, although you think of DSIP for sleep induction, it will actually Epitalon actually has more data showing that it could be beneficial for resetting the circadian rhythm. And so you can actually see it stimulate melatonin production in real time. There was a study that looked at a number of individuals that took Epitalon and their urinary melatonin excretion increased by 1.6 times. And so what it's doing is it's helping, you know, reset the circadian rhythm which I think, historically we're like, oh, we need to use that for our older patients because, our circadian rhythms deteriorate as we get older. Honestly, John, I think everybody needs that now because we're looking at screens 24/7. Like and we are, animals that have an inbuilt biologic clock that has been totally destroyed by kind of the artificial environments that we've placed ourselves in. And, again, I'm all about technology. I'm all about improving that, but we also need to be mindful that, we are still organic. We have not become cyborgs yet. So, take care of the body you got because you only get one.
Have you seen some of the research on melatonin for cancer? Some of that, I mean, it's just
I have
volume
not.
research.
I'd be fascinated to learn more, though. I mean, I take melatonin personally, so I'm a big believer in it. And I understand that's controversial. People are like, oh, you should only take it for a period of time because it could potentially decrease your endogenous production. And now I just joke like, oh, I'm not going to worry about it because I'm just going to take Epitalon whenever I can get access to it.
Now, I did a podcast interview with a melatonin research, and I did two of them with her because it was so fascinating. And there's no LD50 for melatonin, so it never killed anything. It's a lethal dose for half the people who take it. And it actually, because it's really not officially a hormone, it doesn't suppress your own production when you take it. It actually encourages your production. And next time you have a cancer patient, what I want you to do, Alex, is just type in, PubMed, melatonin, and the cancer they have, and watch what happens. You'll be blown away. I mean, just study after study after study after study, whether it be breast cancer or prostate cancer or lung cancer or you name it. It's just sort of mind-boggling that doctors don't know anything about this, obviously, because the pharmaceutical companies don't want you to know. But there's real research there. So, when you're talking about a peptide that increases the natural production, if you do the research on melatonin, that's game changing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's fascinating. No, I have not learned anything about melatonin's use in, the cancer space. I have to confess that, a lot of my for I had former aspirations to be a surgical oncologist in urology, and then I just got way too fascinated with, quality of life and the I don't know, more quality of life medicine. But I got lots of buddies in the cancer space, and I'd love to learn more.
So you're a urologist, obviously you must see a lot of prostate problems with men. Is there a peptide for that?
There is, and it's unfortunately not available here in the United States. It's called I believe Prostamax, if I remember that correctly. I could be incorrect there, but I remember one of my good friends, Abud Bakri, who was giving me a kind of a 411 on it because it's something that's used widely outside the United States, but was never approved here and just hasn't been utilized. And so, I'm interested in learning more about it. Although I have to confess that even as a urologist, I am so far down my rabbit hole that, believe it or not, I have not done anything re with the prostate in about a decade or more. And so I have some amazing colleagues who focus in that. I have totally dedicated my practice to testosterone replacement, to erectile dysfunction, Peyronie's disease, male fertility, and to performance medicine.
It's so funny. My daughter's boyfriend is in Europe right now, and she came up to me. She says, "Dad, Michael's got Peyronie," and I was like, I said, "What?" And I was like, I go, "Are you guys kidding?" And my other daughters were there, and they're like, "What is that?" And I'm trying to do the curved banana thing, and it was so funny. And then I said, "Wait a minute. Are you talking about the beer, Peroni?" And she goes, "Yeah." She goes, "What did you think I was talking about?" I said, "Oh, never
Oh
mind.
no.
Never mind. Never mind." I
Never.
was really worried there for a minute. But
Yeah,
now
also like he's telling you over Skype. That's brave. That's a lot. Yeah.
he was telling my daughter. Yeah, right, exactly. But yeah, obviously that was just so funny that we just had that conversation 10 minutes ago before we got on.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is really, really, really fascinating. Is there anything else that we need to know to kind of be abreast? And I guess my last question to you would be is there anything How do we get peptides normally, naturally, without injecting them? What's the natural way that the body actually, do we have to actually create them in our body and that's how we do it? How does it really work in a natural way?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, the data is pretty clear that people who don't go to sleep on time. So basically, if you induce sleep deprivation, okay, it's like an anti-GLP-1. You make less GLP-1, which induces more hunger, and that's why sleep deprivation can be directly linked to poor eating habits. And so, we make our peptides naturally, and the amount and the efficiency with which we make them is directly affected by our diet and lifestyle. And so I will often tell patients that, I can give you a Band-Aid, but I can't fix the thing that caused the problem until you're willing to, have a serious conversation about lifestyle. So, for example, we've got all of these, kind of nifty tools now, and I love having tools, right? I love being able to use testosterone. I love being able to use GLP-1s. I love being able to, kind of make an immediate impact in patients. But ultimately, if we're being honest, patients ended up in that position because many times, if we're talking about metabolic disease, through poor choices. And it may be through, and again, through no fault of their own, of just not being very mindful about how they live their lives, about what they eat and what they do. And so that's why I think I'm glad we have tools and I'm all about them 100%. But that's also why, I started a YouTube channel, because I'm all about education. And, yes, we need to learn the biology of these compounds. Yes, you have to be your own advocate. But, obviously, sleep 7 to 8 hours a night, learn to move your body. When's the last time that you, stretch or got your cardio in? Resistance train. You have to resistance train. And, believe it or not, if you start to implement those things and you treat health as a skill, you treat health as an investment, something that you put, a couple quarters in that piggy bank every single day, you'd be amazed at all of the problems you don't need pills anymore or for anymore just a couple months down the line.
Does peptide production decline with age?
Yeah, certain peptides, absolutely. And so, for example, there is a whole host of peptides, I believe six in total, that were introduced by a guy named Colonel Cavinson, who is a Russian physician who studied peptides starting, I believe, in the 70s during the Cold War, where what he found is that there were a number of peptides. Like Cardiolax is one that was associated with joint health. Pinealon is another. Epitalon is another, that were all produced naturally, but were declining with age. And he had this, his own institute for gerontology that was totally dedicated to studying these peptides and trying to figure out how administration of them to patients in their old age could improve health outcomes. Now, it's challenging because some of the data they produced from that was way too good to be true. In one study they had Epitalon administration along with some others showing a fourfold decrease in mortality in elderly patients, which is wild. And truth. So again, those were the Institute's patients. We don't really have the ability to externally audit those results. But man, wouldn't it be cool to try and replicate that study, once we get access to these peptides again, and see if it really does make a difference?
So let me ask you this. Which of these would you say is the number one cause of the inability to manufacture your own peptides? Lack of good stomach acid, which would be, which I would imagine is critical because that's where you break down your proteins, correct? Poor sleep and stress levels. Let's talk about those three: poor stomach acid, stress, and poor sleep.
Yeah. What I would say, if I had to rank those as far as, what's the biggest fire, I would put sleep as number one. Just because if you fix your sleep, there's a good chance you've already fixed your stress. Because if you're super stressed all the time, it's hard to get 7 to 8 hours of sleep. So I'm kind of cheating. Yeah. But You know, there is a rhythm to our bodies, and there is a daily rhythm to them. And when you disrespect that, things start falling apart. Like we already talked about how GLP-1 production drops. Okay, so then you start making poor dietary choices. Well, then you start developing, you know, spikes in your sugar, and then you end up developing insulin resistance, and you're eating crap. Your gut microbiome goes to hell. And so all of a sudden, we've got this little snowball at the top of the hill that is, you know, taking out the whole town below it. And so I am a big advocate for sleep and for quality sleep and making sure guys get evaluated for things like sleep apnea, because I've just seen so many downstream consequences from that. So that'd be my number one.
And then my last question about GLP-1. There's so much hype about muscle mass loss with GLP-1. Is that the major side effect that you see, or is there another downside to taking that long term?
So, I will say that again, for patients where it is medically indicated, GLP-1s convey exponentially more benefits than they do drawbacks, because insulin resistance and metabolic disease is so deadly. It's the worst. But there are some things that we note. So, for example, there is some concern about bone density issues with administration of GLP-1s. Now, there is potentially a molecular explanation to that, as to maybe GLP-1s are preventing the building of bone. So your osteoblasts are not being allowed to function at their full capacity. There's also some theory that it's just poor dietary choices and people that are now calorically restricted because they can't fit anything in their stomachs. And, you know, just eating five Twinkies a day as opposed to eating, you know, like your basic protein requirements, I mean, that's going to make a difference. So, the bone density is a question that we still need more answers to. Also, you know, the truth is that, yeah, you do lose about 60% of the weight that you lose. 65% of that is going to be adipose tissue, but about 30% is going to be lean mass. Now, I want to be clear, that's not just skeletal muscle. That's also like, you know, losing water out of different organ systems. Your liver is going to decrease in size. If you know, end up sucking fat out of your liver, that's a good thing. So again, like there are more things are going on than just loss of skeletal muscle, but skeletal muscle is a significant portion of that. And the problem is that if you lose skeletal muscle, well, muscle is your most metabolically active organ by mass. And so you have to have an adequate amount of skeletal muscle. So that's a risk too. You don't want to become what's called sarcopenic, where, you know, you go from being, you know, overweight, but you lose all that fat and you still don't have enough protein, enough muscle mass. So patients have to change. You have need behavioral change. You have to eat enough protein and resistance train in order to develop the muscle reserve to stay metabolically healthy. And, you know, again, if you come off the drugs, you are going to regain a portion of that weight, not all of it, but a significant portion. And so there are a lot of trades in that regard with GLP-1s. Not that it should scare anyone, but it's something that should be known. It should be discussed openly and made part, it should be a part of the shared decision making between a patient and their provider.
So it's sort of like every medication is going to have a benefit and a consequence, and you want to make sure the benefit is greater than the consequence. Now, with peptides, do you generally have, I mean, with GLP-1, you listed some consequences that might not be wonderful. Clearly, the benefit outweighs them. But with the other peptides, the seven that you mentioned, are there drawbacks as well?
There
Consequences?
are depends. So for example, MOTC, I'll tell you, it in some people it can have a very robust local histamine reaction where you inject it, it's kind of red and, you know, angry, almost like you got bit by a mosquito. That same thing can be seen with some of the growth hormone secretagogues, like with epomorelin or CJC, kind of depending on the dose and how concentrated it is. So GHKCU, that's another one. That one stings when you inject it subcutaneously. And so those are all things that you have to keep in mind. There have been reports of an almost anaphylactic type reaction with overdoses on certain peptides. And honestly, I think that's why we need to move past the research use only market, because you're relying on these peptides being dosed appropriately in the powder. Then you have to add enough water, but you don't really get clear instructions on how much to add. And then you have to do the math to draw it up. Like, I'll tell you, even as a physician who prescribes medications that are reconstituted in that fashion, you can give patients explicit instructions: use this much water, put it in the fridge, draw this much up, use this syringe, and you can still get dosing errors in the most controlled setting. So, fully trusting the research use only market, where it's kind of, choose your own adventure, that's not a great public health strategy at scale. So, I think that there are potential pitfalls, but that's why these compounds need to be made available through a prescription from a knowledgeable provider who can have these nuanced conversations with patients.
Wow, that's wonderful. Alex, thank you so much. This has been a wealth of information. I think everyone is going to really, really, feel so grateful for getting up to speed on this whole new world of peptides. For most people, it's sort of in the dark corner of the dark room. People think this is happening, but it's been, like you said, it's been happening. Some of the most amazing medications, like insulin, it's a peptide. It's actually been right in front of our nose. We never knew it. And now it's becoming something that, everyone may have access to and be a game changer. So that's something I'm super grateful for, the work you're doing. And is there anything else that you want to share with us before we let you go?
Yeah, so there is one thing that, and again, like, obviously, like, if for your viewers, I would love it if they would, if they're so moved to come, like, check us out on YouTube at Dr. Alex Tatum, and give us a watch, give us a follow. But there is a rare window to actually make your voice heard, by the federal government, which is a rare thing. And so, right now, if you go to it's regulations.gov. And I'll give you the link to it, John, so you can post it in the show notes if your audience would be interested in this, where you can actually go and you can submit comments for the federal docket for the upcoming July Pharmacy Compounding Advisory Committee meeting. And so if we have any listeners that have had positive experiences with peptides that are eager for access again, because maybe they are suffering from some of the conditions that these peptides may benefit, they can actually submit their comments along with, a concise and accurate history of what they've experienced and how these have been beneficial. And that becomes a mandatory part of the federal record that the PCAC is obligated to review as part of their decision-making process. And man, I would love to just flood that with testimonials from people who have had positive experiences from peptides, or people that want access to peptides because they feel like there's a use case in their situation, because that could be, I don't know, life-changing for millions of people.
All right, Alex Tatum, this has been wonderful. I want to thank your wife for encouraging you to come on. We're super grateful. And I'll definitely be following your YouTube channel and stay abreast of what's going on. And I'm sure you'll be the one to giving us updates as we go, right?
That's the plan. And we've got some really exciting stuff coming down the pipe. I even got access now to some of Dr. Sikorich, is the original guy who discovered BPC-157. I literally have the data from one of his human trials that's never been published that's sitting in my email inbox. And we're going to be able to actually break that down on the channel, examine that, and present that publicly for the first time. And so, yeah, some really cool stuff coming down the pipe.
Wonderful. All right, Alex, thanks again for being here. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, everybody. I just want to take a minute and tell you what we do here at lifespa.com. I've been in practice now for 40 years, 38 of them I've been practicing Ayurvedic medicine full time. For the last 20 years, I've been writing articles and doing videos on the ancient medical wisdom of Ayurveda with the modern science. If something's been around for 1,000 years, still practiced today, and you have modern science to prove it, boy, I really feel like that's something we should all be taking a look at. And that's what we do at lifespa.com. And all that information is for free. So just go to lifespa.com and search in your health topic, and you'll get the information, the article that you need, hopefully that will help you. While you're there, check out our Ayurvedic store. You can get there through lifespa.com or go to store.lifespa.com. And there we have all of our organic Ayurvedic herbs, organic skincare line, more books, tapes, knowledge that we give you is all there at our store. All of our cleansing kits are there in our store. All of our herbs are whole herbs with the natural occurring microbiome, the way it came out of the soil. And that's critically important, because if I took the bugs out of you, you'd be completely different. We take the bugs away from a plant, like sterilizing, making an extract, or spraying your food with pesticides, you lose significant benefit of that plant. And that's why we use the whole plant with the natural occurring microbiome. So check us out, learn more about what we're doing here at lifespa.com, and we'll see you again.
This recording is brought to you by LifeSpa, where ancient Ayurvedic wisdom meets modern science. Get access to free health video newsletters by Dr. John at LifeSpa.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.